Manager Corey Lewandowski cautioned, if you'd like to go on your own, not affiliated with the campaign, you know, that's fine. Page was not a fan of America's foreign policy toward Russia, especially in the Obama era. In this respect, his views were largely consistent with the various public statements made by Trump. Following the speech, Page provided to the campaign what he referred to as a readout or synopsis of his visit to Russia. The information contained therein was derived mainly from listening to other speeches, reading Russian newspapers, and watching Russian television. It was not, he insisted, acquired during surreptitious meetings with Russian leaders who were hoping to influence the 2016 election. According to a transcript of his testimony before the House Intelligence Committee on November 2, 2017, Page suggested to the Trump campaign that the candidate visit Moscow himself to deliver an Obama-like speech on foreign relations. The idea there was bearing in mind Barack Obama's speech as a candidate in Germany in 2008, said Page. That was what I was envisioning. The idea was roundly rejected by the campaign. Page readily admitted to lawmakers that while in Moscow, he had several brief encounters with people in attendance who may have been some senior government officials connected to the Kremlin. This would not have been unusual, given the university's prominent position among elite Russian institutions. He described his interactions as greetings and brief conversation. All of them, he said, were benign and inconsequential. Representative Adam Schiff, the ranking Democrat on the Intelligence Committee, seemed to find something sinister in these incidental encounters, even though Page insisted they were innocuous and did not involve some grand conspiracy to interfere in the presidential election. Undaunted, Schiff grilled Page about having run into Arkady Dvorkovich, the deputy prime minister of Russia, at the conclusion of the speaking event. According to Page, the two men shook hands and said hello in an exchange that lasted less than 10 seconds. Nonetheless, in the congressman's warped view, this constituted some illicit meeting, as he tried to conflate met with meeting. Page did his level best to explain the difference to Schiff, who seemed unwilling to comprehend or accept the difference. Carter Page, I did not meet with him. I greeted him briefly as he was walking off the stage after his speech. Perhaps Schiff was gullible enough to believe the contents of the dossier. More likely, he knew it was worthless, but was determined to use it as a political weapon to impugn Trump with a tall tale of corruption and collusion with the Russians. The 208-page transcript of Page's testimony makes for interesting reading. Schiff comes across as someone who believes that any individual with a foreign-sounding name, especially a Russian, must be a nefarious character who is up to no good. Hence, any interaction with such a person necessarily rises to the level of suspected criminality. It does not. Page is identified several times in the dossier. On page 9 of the document, the July 19, 2016 memo, it is alleged that Page held secret meetings with Igor Sechin, the president of the Russian energy giant Rosneft, and Igor Devekin, a senior Kremlin internal affairs official. The dossier claims the lifting of Western sanctions were discussed, and the Russian officials allegedly hinted that they had kompromat, compromising information, on Trump, which the latter should bear in mind in his dealings with them. The document notes that Page was noncommittal in response. As with all of the allegations in the dossier, this conversation was based on double and even triple hearsay. In other words, someone in Russia supposedly told someone else who allegedly told Steele, who then purportedly summarized the information in his dossier accurately and without prejudice. Single hearsay is unreliable, which is why it is often inadmissible in a court of law. Double hearsay is never allowed. Triple hearsay is a farce. But beyond the anonymous sourcing obstacles based on rank hearsay, there was never any evidence to corroborate that these conversations with Russians happened. No proof has emerged in the nearly 2 years the FBI has been searching for it. Page described the dossier as totally preposterous. The meetings recounted therein never happened, he said. He insisted he did not discuss the Trump campaign with any Russian, never colluded with them, and was not involved in the hacking of Democratic emails. Page 30, the October 18, 2016 memo of the dossier, asserted even more outrageous allegations against Page. He, Sechin, offered Page Trump's associates the brokerage of up to 19% privatized stake in Rosneft in return for lifting sanctions on Russia. Page had expressed interest and confirmed that were Trump elected U.S. president, then sanctions would be lifted. Page vociferously denied this event took place, much less a promise to lift sanctions in exchange for what would surely be billions of dollars in a share of Rosneft. Beyond a shadow of a doubt, there was never any negotiations or any quid pro quo or any offer or any request even in any way related to sanctions. It is laughable for anyone to believe that Russia would confer a 19% stake in one of its most valuable assets, the state-run oil company of Rosneft, in exchange for the prospect of lifting Western sanctions. Based on the asset value and capitalization of the company, the payout would approximate $11 billion. Indeed, at the end of 2017, Rosneft executed an agreement to sell 19.5% to Glencore, a Swiss company, and Qatar's state-owned wealth fund. The deal was valued at approximately $11 billion. Why would leaders at the Kremlin offer such an exorbitant amount of money to an American candidate who might not get elected, or otherwise carry out a promise to lift sanctions that, by any objective economic model, had not caused anything approaching the equivalent damage to the Russian economy? It makes no sense. If the alleged bribe was intended for Page himself, why would Moscow give such money to a volunteer, unpaid junior advisor who had never met the candidate and had few real connections to the campaign? It is a screwball concept that would never pass the smell test of even the wackiest conspiracy theorist. That, of course, did not stop Schiff from advancing the theory. In his opening statement on March 20, 2017, at the committee hearing on Russian interference in the 2016 campaign, the Democratic congressman laid bare his conspiracy theory. According to Steele's Russian sources, Page is offered brokerage fees by such, Igor Sechin, on a deal involving a 19% share of the company, Rosneft. According to Reuters, the sale of a 19.5% share of Rosneft later takes place with unknown purchases and unknown brokerage fees. Is it a coincidence that the Russian gas company Rosneft sold a 19% share after former British intelligence officer Steele was told by Russian sources that Carter Page was offered fees on a deal of just that size? Turns out that Schiff's claims of unknown purchases and unknown brokerage fees were not unknown at all. Glencore and Qatar Fund were the purchasers of the stake. It had nothing to do with and had no connection to Page, Trump, or anyone else in the campaign. Glencore, as Page pointed out in his letter to the committee, was founded by none other than Mark Rich, a billionaire commodity trader who was friends with the Clintons and was infamously pardoned by Bill Clinton in the waning hours of his presidency. As for Schiff's facetious interpretation of a coincidence, it was nothing of the sort. It was well known in the energy sector and other markets that Rosneft was cash poor and looking for investment infusions outside the country to avoid what Bloomberg called self-privatization. Indeed, a July 2016 publication reported that a 19.5% stake was up for sale to the large foreign investors. Before that, the company had been shopping around its investor presentation, searching for buyers. Thus, Steele's reference to the 19% figure would have been known by anyone who was paying attention to Russian energy companies which dominate their economy. It was not a secret. Rosneft desperately needed the $11 billion, and the state-run company was in no financial position to give it away as a speculative political bribe. All of this appears to have been lost on Schiff. Whoever composed the dossier, whether it was Steele or someone else, learned that Page had traveled to Moscow to give a speech. It was well publicized and even televised within Russia. It would serve as an effective way to smear Trump in the media and tangle him up with an FBI investigation. Perhaps some incriminating evidence could be discovered along the way, but that was only a secondary purpose. When the FBI learned of the dossier in early July 2016, it could have simply questioned Page about its allegations and asked him to account for his whereabouts and conversations while in Moscow. This would have made sense since Page had assisted the Bureau once before and became a cooperating witness in prior Russian prosecutions. Indeed, under the FISA law, U.S. law enforcement is required to undertake normal investigative techniques before resorting to surveillance, as former federal prosecutor Andrew McCarthy pointed out. The FBI did not comply with the law, which speaks volumes about their own political motivations to intercede in the presidential contest. You'd have to be intolerably ignorant not to recognize the Steele dossier for what it was, a politically driven collection of fables designed to defame and discredit Trump. Regardless, once created, it was then appropriated by high government officials at the FBI and DOJ to try to commandeer the election process, defeat Trump, and elevate Clinton. When the odious plot failed to succeed, the conspirators doubled down and sought ways to destroy the new president. Spying on Trump was one of their gambits. It was the kind of government abuse of surveillance powers that Justice Holmes argued against. Chapter 7. Government Abuse of Surveillance. We are rapidly entering the age of no privacy, where everyone is open to surveillance at all times, where there are no secrets from government. Justice William O. Douglas, Osborne v. United States, 385 United States Supreme Court, 323, page 341, 1966. To convince a judge to issue a warrant to search, seize, or surveil someone, the government must demonstrate that its information is reliable. It must present facts it has gathered that come from a credible person. In this case, both the facts and the individual who provided them were untrustworthy. The FBI and DOJ surely knew it. The Fourth Amendment to the Constitution demands what is called probable cause whenever the government desires a warrant from a judge. This means there must exist a fair probability that a search or surveillance will produce evidence of a crime. The affidavit or application submitted to the court must present sufficiently credible information, normally from witnesses, to establish the probable cause. If the information is hearsay, it is vital that the source of the information be a reliable person. In the FISA warrant application to spy on Page, the FBI knew early on that Steele was not a credible source. They learned that his assignment from Fusion GPS was purely for political reasons to damage Trump. They also learned that his efforts were funded by Trump's election opponent Hillary Clinton's campaign and the Democratic National Committee. This alone should have been enough for the FBI to disregard Steele and discard his dossier as lacking reliability, as the law demands. Then there is the dossier itself. As explained previously, it was outlandish in its claims and phony in its composition. Any serious person who bothered to scrutinize its contents would conclude it was bogus on its face. The fact that it was supposedly conveyed from anonymous foreign sources and then purveyed through an alleged series of multiple hearsay conversations made it seem all the more puerile and silly. The sourcing of the dossier was insufficient by American legal standards to establish probable cause. Fusion GPS and Glenn Simpson. The dossier may have been sifted from the creative imagination of Christopher Steele, but the endeavor was the brainchild of a former journalist by the name of Glenn Simpson. He, more than anyone else, was responsible for initiating and proliferating the collusion myth. Simpson founded a company called Fusion GPS, which conducts investigations and research. Initially, a conservative website hired Fusion to create opposition research on candidate Trump in September 2015. But when it became obvious that the businessman and television impresario would become the GOP nominee, the website stopped funding the work in the spring of 2016. The Clinton campaign and the DNC, through their lawyer Elias, hired Fusion to develop new negative research on Trump. Only thereafter did Simpson retain the services of Steele and his company Orbis. Their assignment was to investigate Trump and establish the claim that he was collaborating with Russia. Almost immediately, Steele produced the first in a series of memos that became the infamous dossier based on his anonymous, supposed sources. In testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee on August 22, 2017, Simpson was repeatedly questioned whether he took any steps to verify the allegations in the document. It appears he did little because he said he trusted the ex-spy. Did that mean Steele's information was equally trustworthy? Here, Simpson's answer seems muddled. Chris Steele deals in a very different kind of information, which is human intelligence, human information, so by its very nature, the question of whether something is accurate isn't really asked. It should have been asked. It was reckless and irresponsible not to ask. Specific and detailed information about the origins and methods of soliciting and securing the materials should have been demanded. The report was so offensive and the accusations against Trump were so severe that anything less than the strictest scrutiny would have been irresponsible. But it seems that Simpson was more interested in the political havoc he could wreak on the Republican nominee than in accuracy and truth. One by one, Simpson was questioned about the succession of memos compiled by Steele and whether Fusion GPS ever corroborated any parts of the dossier. As to one memo, he stated, "Most of this I did not seek to independently verify and was relatively new information." As to another memo, he said, "I can't talk about this as a verification, but I was analyzing this. I analyzed this information in the same manner I analyzed the other stuff." When questioned about still another memo, there was this exchange. Question. Just moving on to the next memo. Again, when you take a look at that, was there anything that you independently verified that comes out of this memo? Answer. I don't think so. Simpson gave similar answers as to other memos from Steele. To summarize, he appeared to have done almost nothing to verify the explosive allegations in the dossier. Beyond its content, what about Steele's anonymous sources? Here's an exchange with Senate investigators addressing that question. Question. Did you take any steps to try to assess the credibility of Steele's sources in the material that he was providing you? Answer. Yes, but I'm not going to get into sourcing information. Perhaps he declined to talk about it because there was no sourcing information. It's hard to imagine that Simpson, who did not speak Russian and did not travel to the country while developing his anti-Trump opposition research, would have been in a position to verify Steele's so-called sources, especially since they were anonymous. He admitted that none of his own work made it into the dossier, which suggests he did little except pay Steele for his tall tale of Trump's collusion with the Kremlin. A full reading of Simpson's 311 pages of testimony will leave you with the distinct impression that he may never have asked whether Steele's information was accurate. Moreover, there is no indication Simpson or anyone at Fusion GPS searched for any independent proof to substantiate the many scurrilous claims contained therein. That did not, however, stop Simpson from conveying the information to journalists. He and Steele shared with reporters the contents of the dossier in the summer and fall of 2016, yet he conceded he did not tell them it was opposition research funded by the Clinton campaign and Democrats, which would surely have affected the media's view of it. He was asked this question about providing material to journalists. Question. And they're aware you're being paid to do that research for a client? Answer. I don't know. Generally, that's not an issue. Brief exchange with Simpson's lawyer. Question. My question was whether or not they knew you were being paid to do that research. Lawyer. He answered that question too, and he said he did not explain that to the journalists. Other than his disdain for Trump's suitability to be president, Simpson was convinced there was some illicit collaboration between the Russians and the campaign. He seemed to have formed the opinion that Carter Page's speech in Moscow constituted a sordid element of the conspiracy, even though it was perfectly legal and fairly innocuous. The fact that Page had earlier been caught up as a witness in a Russian spy ring case appeared to have reinforced Simpson's impression of potential criminal conduct. As mentioned previously, Page was never charged with any wrongdoing and appears to have been a target of a Russia operative, not a willing participant in a spy ring. Although Simpson had no real proof of Trump-Russian collaboration, he testified that he thought Donald Trump Jr.'s meeting with a Russian lawyer in Trump Tower in June 2016 was a form of corroboration, even though no one in the media discovered the meeting for at least another year. After Simpson's experience before the Senate committee, the House Intelligence Committee subpoenaed two other executives of Fusion GPS, Peter Fritsch and Thomas Kattan. As to every question posed, the two men invoked their Fifth Amendment rights against self-incrimination. They likely knew, better than Simpson, the extent to which they were facing legal jeopardy. Fusion GPS has long been accused of employing underhanded tactics. In advance of Simpson's appearance, the Senate committee heard sworn testimony from others who claimed that they too had been victimized by prepared dossiers containing false information and carefully placed slanderous news items. The anti-Trump dossier was another quintessential operation run by Fusion GPS. Kimberly Strassel of the Wall Street Journal wrote, "Fusion is known as a ruthless firm that excels in smear jobs. But the Trump assignment was their most notorious. The title of Strassel's column, The Fusion Collusion, was felicitous. She took aim not just at the firm, but at the Democratic Party, whose most powerful members have made protecting fusion secrets their highest priority. It was collusion at an atrocious level. Under questioning, Simpson confirmed that Steele made contact with the FBI during the first week of July, just as the Bureau was absolving Clinton. Simpson admitted he agreed with Steele's decision to reach out to the Bureau and probably encouraged him to do so. Simpson and Steele both spoke with the media to push their dossier on them because, as Simpson stated, some of it was gathered for the possibility that it might be useful to the press. How hard did Simpson push? Perhaps to the point of actually paying journalists. On November 21, 2017, the Washington Examiner reported on the existence of court documents that showed Fusion GPS made payments to three journalists during the same time Simpson was talking to reporters about the dossier. The names of the journalists were withheld, but the three are known to have reported on Russia issues. Fusion's lawyer argued that the payments were compensation for information from the journalists, not to pay journalists to write stories. It was an excuse that shattered common sense. While Simpson and Steele were talking to reporters from five different media outlets, and Steele was meeting with the FBI, Fusion GPS and Steele were also promoting the dossier to a high official at the Justice Department, Bruce Orr. It turns out that his wife, Nellie H. Orr, was a paid employee of Fusion GPS, who wrote extensively about Russian topics. According to the House Intelligence Committee, she provided opposition research on Trump in collaboration with Steele's dossier. Her husband, who was Associate Deputy Attorney General, held secret meetings with both Simpson and Steele. The Orr-Fusion entente was not disclosed by Simpson when he testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Nor was it disclosed by the Justice Department when it learned of Orr's meetings with the proponents of the dossier and quietly demoted him. It kept the scandal hidden, perhaps in the hopes that no one would discover that Simpson and Steele were covertly providing the DOJ with the unverified document funded by the Clinton campaign that was being used to spy on her opponent's team. Even after the November presidential election, Orr was meeting with Simpson as the secret surveillance of Page continued. It is not clear what actions Orr, armed with the inflammatory dossier, may have taken, because the Justice Department has never been forthcoming about what exactly he did. The DOJ's efforts to cover up Orr's activities were unconscionable, and so too was Orr's conduct. Since his wife worked for Fusion GPS and contributed to the dossier, the relationship presented a disqualifying conflict of interest for Orr, who was legally obligated under DOJ regulations to recuse himself from any investigation in which his wife was involved. He did not seek a waiver of the conflict. Upon joining the Justice Department, he had signed an agreement stating that he would be fired for violating its rules. Inexplicably, he was not terminated, which only reinforces the impression that impropriety and concealment continued at the highest levels of the department. Not only did Bruce Orr fail to disclose that Fusion GPS was paying his wife, but it appears he did not fully report the nature of the work performed in financial disclosure reports as required under Justice Department regulations. Willfully filing a false report constitutes a crime under Title 18 of USC Section 1001. Hillary Clinton tried to dismiss her role in paying for the dossier by stating that it was simply opposition research. While it is true that political campaigns often use such research, what Clinton, Simpson, Fusion GPS, and Steele did was antithetical to any definition of research. In a column published by The Hill, Ned Ryan explained it this way. Opposition research is based on fact, from voting records, court records, and public statements, to tax returns and business relationships. Fusion GPS's dossier, on the other hand, was misinformation. It was not opposition research because it was not based on fact. Given Fusion GPS's dependence on Russian gossip spread by Vladimir Putin's spies, there is a good case to be made that Fusion GPS more deeply colluded with the Russians than anyone else did. And so, too, did Clinton, since she helped fund the effort. There was never any evidence Trump or his associates colluded with Russia to win the election. But there is substantial evidence that Clinton and Democrats colluded with Simpson, Fusion GPS, and Christopher Steele, a foreign national, to influence the election by defeating Trump. And Russians, according to Steele, participated by providing real or imagined Kremlin sources. Distilled to its essence, the scam worked like this. Clinton's campaign paid Simpson, who paid Steele, who allegedly got information from Moscow intended to damage Trump and help Clinton. Then the FBI and the Justice Department exploited the dubious information as a pretense to open an investigation of Trump, while the media ran with their stories intended to bring down the new president. The government abused its powers, and the press was shamefully complicit. The two congressional intelligence memos, when read in light of Steele's admissions and Simpson's testimony, give sustenance to the inescapable conclusion that the dossier was a fraud. Its author was considered by the FBI to be a liar. Despite this, government officials at the FBI and DOJ secretly collaborated with both Steele and Simpson to obtain their warrants to spy on the Trump campaign without full disclosure of the facts and the kind of legal justification required in our system of justice. When Trump was elected, and even after he took office, the surveillance continued. The chronology of events demonstrates that the fictitious dossier was the pretext for the FBI's probe of Trump, not Papadopoulos's so-called bar talk. Steele composed his first memo alleging Trump-Russia collusion on June 20th, then met with the FBI on July 5th. On July 31st, the investigation of Trump was formally opened. Only thereafter, on August 2nd, did FBI agents meet with the Australian diplomat to gather information about Papadopoulos. The Spy Game. Carter Page was never charged with any crime. The reason is quite simple. He did nothing wrong. Instead, he became an unwitting pawn in the government's attempt to implicate Trump for something. Anything. Page cooperated with the FBI beginning in 2013 when the Bureau was investigating three Russians suspected of trying to recruit an American to act as a foreign agent. It was understandable that Page had communicated with numerous Russians, given his global energy interests and the 3 years he spent in Moscow. He had no idea that one of the people with whom he had spoken was a Russian operative in a suspected spy ring. The FBI reportedly surveilled Page through a succession of Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, warrants beginning in 2014, but found no evidence to implicate him, and thus, no charges were brought against him. Instead, Page is on the record stating that he actively assisted the Bureau in its prosecution of the case. All known evidence indicates this is true. He was working with the FBI against Russia, not for it. Under the FISA law, recruitment as a foreign agent is not enough to sustain the burden of probable cause to surveil someone. The statute is quite strict and limited in its scope. Former federal prosecutor Andrew McCarthy explained this quite well in a column he penned for National Review. The fact that a foreign power is trying to recruit an American to become an agent for that foreign power is not a sufficient basis to issue a surveillance warrant against the American under FISA. It would, of course, be sufficient to issue a warrant against the foreign spies who are making the recruitment efforts, but it is not enough for a warrant against the American citizen who is the target of the recruitment effort. To get a surveillance warrant under FISA, the FBI and Justice Department must establish probable cause that the person to be monitored under the warrant is acting as an active, purposeful agent of a foreign power, not that the foreign power hopes to turn him into such an agent. Fast forward to 2016. The FBI learned that Page had been named to the Trump Foreign Policy Council. Newly armed with a dossier that identified Page as participating in a fictitious meeting with Russians while delivering his speech in Moscow, Bureau agents had the perfect excuse to begin spying on Trump and his campaign by seeking a FISA warrant to wiretap Page's phones in October and gain access to his stored communications. There were legal impediments to convincing the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, or FISC, to grant another warrant to spy on Page. New evidence would have to be provided that would justify yet another wiretap of a person who had been tapped before with no result. A majority of the House Intelligence Committee later concluded that the endeavor required sleight-of-hand trickery by the FBI and the Justice Department to gain the court's permission. Evidence would have to be concealed, and the judge would have to be deceived. All that was necessary was to inflate the importance of the dossier, obscure the true nature of its authorship, downplay its fabricated content, camouflage its partisan motives, and hide that it was paid for by the true target's political opponents. House Intelligence Committee Memo. On February 2, 2018, the House Intelligence Committee declassified a 4-page memorandum and made it public. The findings composed by a majority of Republicans on the committee were derived from testimony under oath and documents obtained pursuant to subpoenas. Here are the main points of what became known as the Nunes Memo, named after the chairman of the committee, Congressman Devin Nunes. FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe testified that no surveillance warrant would have been sought from the FISC without the Steele dossier information. Christopher Steele compiled the dossier and admitted to Deputy Attorney General Bruce Orr that he was desperate that Donald Trump not get elected and was passionate about him not being president. Steele's bias was recorded in FBI files but not reflected in any of the warrant applications presented to the court. Orr's wife worked for Fusion GPS and assisted in the anti-Trump research, and Orr gave his wife's research to the FBI. The Orr's relationship with Steele and Fusion GPS was concealed from the court. The FBI assessed the dossier as only minimally corroborated. The dossier was funded by the Hillary Clinton campaign and the Democratic National Committee, or DNC. None of the surveillance warrant applications disclosed this funding, even though the political origins were known to senior DOJ and FBI officials. The FBI and DOJ cited a Yahoo News story about Page to support the warrant application, without disclosing that it came from the same source as the dossier, Steele. Steele was terminated by the FBI because he lied to the Bureau about his contacts with the media and disclosure of information. After Steele was fired, he continued contact with Orr at the DOJ. FBI Director James Comey briefed President-elect Trump on the dossier at a time when he knew it was salacious and unverified. Comey, McCabe, and others signed the warrant applications when they knew it was unreliable and unverified. The results of the committee's investigation were stunning. The FBI and DOJ knew the dossier was unverified conjecture. They knew it was paid for by Clinton and Democrats and was politically motivated. They knew the person who compiled it despised Trump and harbored a clear bias, and they knew they could not spy on a Trump associate without the dossier. Despite all of this, the FBI and DOJ used it anyway, deceiving the court by actively withholding or obscuring every bit of vital information. The government spied on Carter Page by obtaining 4 different warrants at 90-day intervals, which means the surveillance lasted for roughly a year, starting October 21, 2016. But it also allowed the FBI to get its hands on any of Page's stored communications he had in the past. It was a way to spy on him going forward and backward. Nothing of consequence was ever found, which only reinforced how unwarranted the intrusion was to begin with. The House Intelligence Committee's evisceration of the original FISA application demonstrates that the judge who approved the initial warrant, had he known the truth, would surely have rejected the government's request to spy on Page because the application was based substantially on faulty evidence submitted to the court and FISA procedures were ignored. While the basis for the subsequent renewal applications for the warrant have not been publicly disclosed, we can reasonably assume they were riddled with the same defects and deceptions. Among those who signed the warrant applications were then FBI Director James Comey and current Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. It did not end there. When Trump fired Comey, it was Rosenstein who appointed Comey's good friend and former colleague Robert Mueller as special counsel to investigate Trump. These all-too-cozy relationships, solidified amid arguably corrupt acts, served as the underpinnings of the case against the president. Such egregious conduct by high government officials was anathema to fairness and justice. Democrats' Rebuttal Memo. Predictably, Democrats who had fought so hard to stop the release of the Intelligence Committee memo condemned its findings even before it was made public. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi called it bogus. She and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer demanded that Devin Nunes be removed as chairman of the committee. Representative Adam Schiff claimed the memo was rife with factual inaccuracies and gave a distorted view of the FBI. Hardly. The Nunes memo was neither bogus nor inaccurate. There was no discernible distortion. Each and every finding was based on the sworn testimony of witnesses who had been interviewed or documents that were obtained by the committee, many pursuant to lawful subpoenas. The memo was short on analysis, but long on established facts. None of the released information jeopardizes sources or methods in intelligence operations. Nonetheless, the FBI took the unusual step of issuing a statement strongly objecting to it being made public. Such criticism by the Bureau was understandable, given that the information detailed how the FBI and DOJ had seemingly abused their powers to spy on a former Trump campaign advisor. Immediately after its release, Schiff vowed to construct his own memorandum to serve as a rebuttal. He and his colleagues on the committee did so. But unlike Democrats who had voted to stop the Republican memo's release, Republicans voted unanimously to make public the Democrats' memo. While Schiff had suggested that his memo would contradict many of the findings of the Nunes memo, it accomplished precious little of that. Instead, a close reading of the document showed that it largely supported the earlier findings, although the new memo strained to massage the facts in a light most favorable to the FBI and Justice Department. It also strove to deflect attention to other issues extraneous to the warrant application. On balance, Schiff's memo contained mostly opinions and argument in a pronounced attempt to reimagine what had so obviously occurred before the FISA court. Conclusions were drawn in the absence of foundational facts. For example, the new memo claimed that the government had followed all the proper procedures before the court, did not abuse the FISA process, and met the rigor, transparency, and evidentiary basis needed to meet the FISA's probable cause requirement for the issuance of a warrant to surveil Page. These statements were not even close to being accurate. As explained earlier, the FBI did not interview Page when it learned of the dossier, even though it was required to exhaust all normal investigative techniques before seeking a warrant to surveil. Page had previously been a cooperating informant for the FBI. Instead of spying on him, the Bureau should have simply talked to him to determine whether the allegations against him bore any truth or whether the surveillance was even merited. Schiff's memo asserted that the FISA court was properly informed about the partisan backing of the dossier. This was sincere in only the most distorted sense. Burying cryptic references in a document's footnotes that disguised the specific names or identities of the Clinton campaign and the DNC hardly constitutes an informed court, especially when the funding of the dossier by a political opponent is an indispensable fact for consideration by a judge who is attempting to discern both credibility and motivations. Steele's partisan funding should have been clearly and deliberately highlighted for the court. Rather, it was intentionally camouflaged. The Democratic memo went to extraordinary lengths to argue that Steele was credible, ignoring the fact that the FBI fired him for lying and was relying on mostly anonymous sources whose credibility, much less identity, could not be determined or substantiated. This was not fully or truthfully explained to the court. A principal source who lies has no credibility, which means his claims utilizing other unidentified sources who supposedly gave him information are equally untenable. The most astonishing claim in Schiff's memo was that, after the first surveillance, DOJ provided additional information obtained through multiple independent sources that corroborated Steele's reporting. Conveniently, this information was heavily redacted, so there was no way of knowing whether it was true. Common sense dictates that it was not. If support for Steele's claims was collected during the surveillance or through other means, why wasn't Page ever charged with a crime? The answer should be obvious. There was no corroborating evidence. In the alternative, whatever was collected was of insignificant evidentiary value. Finally, most notable in the Democratic rebuttal memo was what was missing. When the Nunes memo revealed that Deputy FBI Director McCabe testified that no warrant would have been sought without the dossier, Democrats insisted this was erroneous and that their memo would dispute this finding. It did not. Why? It was omitted likely because what McCabe reportedly said to the committee was true. Fred Fleitz, who spent 19 years at the CIA and also once served as a senior staff member on the House Intelligence Committee, described it this way. This is one of the most crucial points in the Republican memo, but the Democrats ignored it. This is a major omission. Either McCabe did or did not say the Steele dossier was the crucial information that drove the FISA warrant request. The committee's Republicans should declassify the transcript of McCabe's remarks to expose what is very likely a huge Democratic misrepresentation. In the end, the Democratic rebuttal managed to rebut almost nothing of any consequence. How could it? Director Comey admitted to Trump that some, if not all, of the dossier was salacious and unverified. Reportedly, Deputy Director McCabe reiterated the same to Congress when he testified behind closed doors. Most importantly, Page had been a credible witness for the FBI, and there was no trustworthy or corroborating evidence he had done anything wrong. None of this deterred the government from relying on the dossier to spy on Page in an apparent attempt to inflict harm on Trump, his campaign, and his presidency. The evidence shows that the bulk of the warrant application was wholly contingent on Steele and his dirty dossier. There was nothing else. Without it, the FISA court would never have countenanced surveillance by granting the initial and subsequent warrants. Substantial reliance on the dossier was confirmed by yet another committee's findings on the other side of the Capitol. The Grassley-Graham Senate Memo. It wasn't just the House Intelligence Committee's majority members who found shocking evidence that government officials had deceived the FISA court to spy on Trump campaign advisor Carter Page. On the Senate side, the Judiciary Committee conducted a separate investigation and gathered its own set of incriminating evidence. A memorandum co-signed by Committee Chairman Charles E. Grassley and Chairman of the Subcommittee on Crime and Terrorism, Lindsey O. Graham, set forth an equally compelling case of wrongdoing by the FBI and Department of Justice in obtaining their surveillance warrant, which allowed them to secretly listen in on Page's conversations and to seize any of his past electronic communications, such as text messages or emails. Bear in mind, the warrant was obtained after Page had left the Trump campaign in the fall of 2016. The Senate memo completely confirmed the findings contained in the House memo, but produced even more evidence of impropriety by high government officials. The FBI never corroborated any of the main claims in the dossier. The FBI represented to the FISA court that Steele was reliable and credible. The FBI learned Steele was not reliable and had lied almost immediately after seeking the initial warrant, but did not notify the court of this. The FBI knew Steele had talked with the media, but the Bureau informed the court otherwise. The FBI cited a second source for its information, knowing it came from the original source. The FBI continued to vouch for Steele in subsequent warrants, even though he had been terminated because he was no longer credible. FBI Director Comey knew the dossier was unverified, but signed off on the warrant applications anyway. The FBI knew of the political origins of the dossier, but buried this material information in a footnote in the warrant applications. The FBI knew that Clinton associates were also feeding Steele anti-Trump information. These accounts, uncovered by the Senate Judiciary Committee, were troubling on many different levels. The FBI's eagerness to unearth deleterious material on Trump was the driving force behind the Bureau's actions to spy on one of his campaign associates, Page. In the process, the FBI and DOJ deliberately misused the FISA court to secure a warrant to spy. They deceived a succession of judges by willfully misrepresenting the information in their possession, vouching for its credibility while likely knowing full well that it was, in a word, incredible. The Senate memo left little doubt that the FBI and DOJ tricked the FISA court by masking their knowledge that the dossier was nothing more than a political hit job. Grassley and Graham had access to the FISA warrant applications and found a stunning fact. The government was hiding something quite important. The FBI discussed the reliability of this unverified information provided by Mr. Steele in footnotes 8 and 18 of the FISA warrant application. First, the FBI noted to a vaguely limited extent the political origins of the dossier. In footnote 8, the FBI stated that the dossier information was compiled pursuant to the direction of a law firm who had hired an identified U.S. person, now known as Glenn Simpson of Fusion GPS, redacted. The application failed to disclose that the identities of Mr. Simpson's ultimate clients were the Clinton campaign and the DNC. Even if a discerning judge read every single footnote, he or she would never have discovered that it was Clinton and the Democrats who had helped manufacture the sketchy dossier, in concert with an opposition research firm, Fusion GPS. It was nowhere in print. Their identities were not disclosed. Listen closely to footnote 8, in which the government and Democrats insist they revealed the political nature of the dossier's origins. It is a model of obfuscation. Source number 1 was approached by an identified U.S. person who indicated to source number 1 that a U.S.-based law firm had hired the identified U.S. person to conduct research regarding candidate number 1's ties to Russia. The identified U.S. person and source number 1 have a long-standing business relationship. The identified U.S. person hired source number 1 to conduct this research. The identified U.S. person never advised source number 1 as to the motivation behind the research into candidate number 1's ties to Russia. The FBI speculates that the identified U.S. person was likely looking for information that could be used to discredit candidate number 1's campaign. A FISA judge, or any human being for that matter, would have to be telepathic to comprehend the facts underlying this well-disguised footnote. The Clinton campaign and Democrats were the ones who paid for the anti-Trump dossier that was manufactured by Fusion GPS and contrived by a foreign national, Christopher Steele, who based his unverified information on dubious Russian hearsay sources who may or may not exist. The FISA judges, assuming they even read the footnote, could never have discerned the truth because it was so well concealed. The political motivations and funding behind the dossier were crucial and indispensable facts that should have been highlighted to the court by the FBI and the DOJ, not obscured in a couple of footnotes that never revealed a clear and honest version of how the document was generated. This underscores just how sneaky and misleading top government officials were in their representations before the FISA judges. The FBI and DOJ well knew that they could mask the truth and get away with it. It is a documented fact that 99% of all FISA applications are approved. The government was aware of this and knew it would gain permission because the judges trusted officers of the court to be honest in their representations. The FISA court operates in secret. It is not an adversarial venue. No opposing views are presented because no other side is present. The integrity of the process is entirely dependent on the government being truthful and forthright. There were other unprincipled tactics employed by the FBI, some of which would constitute outright fraud in any other circumstance or venue. Did the Bureau or the Justice Department ever advise the court it had fired Steele because he lied? No. They prevaricated in another carefully worded footnote that he was terminated only because of an unauthorized disclosure of information to the press. This was a half-truth at best. Did they tell the court their second source, a media story, was based on the original source? No. That inconvenient fact was omitted. In short, the evidence revealed that Steele lied, then the FBI covered it up and misled the FISA court. Senate investigators also uncovered another extraordinary fact. Not only did the Clinton campaign fund Steele's phony dossier, but Clinton's allies provided some of the bogus information contained therein. Mr. Steele's memorandum states that his company received this report from, redacted, U.S. State Department, that the report was the second in a series, and that the report was information that came from a foreign subsource who is in touch with, redacted, a contact of, redacted, a friend of the Clintons, who passed it to, redacted. It is troubling enough that the Clinton campaign funded Mr. Steele's work, but that these Clinton associates were contemporaneously feeding Mr. Steele allegations raises additional concerns about his credibility. Clearly, the Clinton campaign and her associates were the driving force behind the dossier that was used to spy on her political opponent and investigate the Trump campaign. But Comey appears to have covered up the FBI's interactions with Steele. The Senate Judiciary Committee accused him of providing it with an account that was inconsistent with information contained in FISA applications the chairman and ranking member later reviewed. The committee concluded, "It is unclear whether this was a deliberate attempt to mislead members of Congress," and he thereafter refused to resolve discrepancies he provided in a closed briefing and information contained in classified documents. One of the lesser-known facts is that Steele himself cast doubt on the truth of his own dossier. In a defamation case brought against him in a British court, Steele was forced to answer questions propounded by what American courts call interrogatories, which are written questions that must be responded to under a signed statement of truth. In criminal jeopardy if he lied, Steele admitted that his claims against Trump in the dossier were derived from raw intelligence based on limited intelligence. Steele further acknowledged his accusations against the Trump campaign were unverifiable and that his sources would likely deny the allegations. In a veiled reference to the partisan motivations behind the document, the role of Fusion GPS and the Clinton campaign, he cautioned, "Its contents must be critically viewed in light of the purpose for and circumstances in which the information was collected." This was a subtle way of confessing that Steele's work was not worth the paper on which it was written. In plain language, it was an untruthful political attack intended to vilify an opposing candidate. In light of the FBI's determination that Steele had lied to agents, Grassley and Graham requested that the Department of Justice open a criminal investigation into Steele's conduct for potential prosecution of making false and misleading statements. The senator said Steele's actions precipitated a chain of events that had a serious and harmful impact when it declared, "Mr. Steele's apparent deception seems to have posed significant material consequences on the FBI's investigative decisions and representations to the court." Abuse of power and other crimes. Under the FISA law, the government was required to establish probable cause not only that Carter Page was acting as a foreign agent for Russia, but that he committed some identifiable federal crime while doing so. The dossier purported that Page was an agent working with the Kremlin to carry out a bribery scheme and other crimes, but beyond the wild assertions in the document, there was no other independent or supporting evidence. It appears that the FBI and DOJ relied entirely on Steele and his dossier in their probable cause of proof of both agent and crime. Since the document itself was completely unverified, based on multiple hearsay, funded by an opposing political campaign, and compiled by a foreign national who admitted he was desperate that Donald Trump not get elected, it was woefully inadequate for the purpose of gaining a warrant to surveil. It might have been enough for a tabloid rag at the checkout counter of a supermarket, but it came nowhere near being sufficient in any court of law in America, especially a federal intelligence surveillance court, deciding whether there was probable cause to grant legal approval to engage in one of the most serious intrusions on a constitutional right, that is, to spy on a U.S. citizen. Had the judges who signed the succession of four warrants to surveil Page known the truth about Steele and his dossier, it is highly doubtful that they would ever have signed off on it. The judges were relying on the honesty and integrity of the FBI and DOJ officials to be candid and forthright in their representations. After all, the lawyers who submitted and argued the matter were considered officers of the court. They were duty-bound by law and ethics to be truthful. It seems they were not. Instead, they appear to have concealed vital evidence and deceived the court. Comey, in particular, deserves recrimination. His signature is on the early warrant applications, although he admitted to Congress that he believed the dossier was salacious and unverified. Within 10 days of signing the first application, Steele was terminated for breaching his agreement not to speak with the media and lying about it. Comey should have immediately notified the FISA court that the FBI's confidential informant was no longer a reliable source and ended the surveillance of Page. He did not. Instead, he allowed the spying to continue and signed 2 more warrant application extensions that were dependent on Steele and his dossier. As FBI director, Comey should never have allowed such an unsubstantiated document compiled by a biased and discredited source to be utilized to spy on an associate of a presidential candidate. The surveillance continued under Comey's direction even after Trump became president. According to congressional investigators, FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe told Congress when he testified behind closed doors in December 2017 that the Bureau had verified none of the claims in the dossier, except that Page had given a speech in Moscow. The speech, as he pointed out, was not unusual and perfectly legal. The visit was also a matter of public knowledge, which Steele could have easily acquired to insert in his dossier for the purpose of mischaracterizing it as some clandestine plot to conspire with the Russians. McCabe, like Comey, signed off on the last FISA application, knowing full well its conspicuous deficiencies. Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates and her successor Rod Rosenstein also signed warrant applications affirming their belief in the contents of the dossier, its accuracy, and the reliability of their source, Steele. Surely they also knew the legal justification for their surveillance was deeply flawed, yet they did it anyway. If the dossier was the primary basis for the warrant to surveil and it was nevertheless unverified, as McCabe reportedly admitted to Congress, then the legal justification for the warrant to surveil was insufficient as a matter of law. This means that all evidence collected as a consequence of the surveillance can never be used in a prosecution of any person, in what is known as the exclusionary rule and a companion doctrine known as the fruit of the poisonous tree. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled that defective warrants and improper searches which violate a person's constitutional rights under the Fourth and Fifth Amendments serve as a bar to any evidence derived therefrom. These rules apply specifically, but not exclusively, to cases involving wiretaps. Whatever evidence the FBI, the Justice Department, or the special counsel extracted from Page's emails, texts, and wiretapped conversations can never be used in any prosecution against him or anyone else. This effectively forecloses a collusion case unless evidence was acquired through other means completely unconnected to the dossier. However, high-ranking officials at the FBI and DOJ could and should be prosecuted for using their positions of authority to abuse the law and the constitutional rights of American citizens. At least six different felony statutes appear to have been broken. First, it is a crime for government officials to use their position to deprive someone of their constitutional rights. Known to some as the Abuse of Power Statute, Title 18 of the USC Section 242, its formal name is Deprivation of Rights Under Color of Law. Referring to the Department of Justice analysis of this statute found on the DOJ's website, the following is stated. Section 242 of Title 18 makes it a crime for a person acting under color of any law to willfully deprive a person of a right or privilege protected by the Constitution or laws of the United States. For the purpose of Section 242, acts under color of law include acts not only done by federal, state, or local officials within their lawful authority, but also acts done beyond the bounds of that official's lawful authority, if the acts are done while the official is purporting to or pretending to act in the performance of his or her official duties. The FBI's website offers the same legal interpretation. Some have suggested that this law applies only to cases involving discrimination against protected classes of people. This is not true. The Justice Department's published opinion makes this clear. It is not necessary that the crime be motivated by animus toward the race, color, religion, sex, handicap, familial status, or national origin of the victim. What constitutional rights were violated? As to Carter Page, his right to privacy, affirmed by the U.S. Supreme Court as a constitutional right, was abridged by the actions of the FBI and DOJ when they spied on him. Also, his Fourth Amendment right to be secure against unreasonable searches and seizures in the absence of probable cause was violated. Donald Trump's constitutional right to run for the public office of president may also have been violated, since it appears that the real purpose of the FBI's criminal investigation and surveillance of his former campaign advisor was to discover incriminating evidence against Trump to impede or disrupt his candidacy and, later, his presidency with the taint of Russian collusion. Upon conviction, the offense is punishable by a range of imprisonment up to a life term, depending upon the circumstances of the crime and the resulting injury, if any. A second potential crime is perjury, as set forth in Title 18 of the USC Section 1621 and Section 1623. These two statutes criminalize lying under oath or in any statement under penalty of perjury in federal court if a person willfully subscribes as true any material matter which he does not believe to be true. Concealing important information regarding the dossier from the FISA court, such as the political source of funding, the deceit of the document's author, and the unverified nature of its contents, would be obvious material matters. It appears to have been done willfully because the FBI and the DOJ were aware of this information but chose not to disclose it. Because the FISA court proceedings are held in secret and the warrant applications are not made public, it is unclear what oaths or affirmations were made in court. If it was similar to most court proceedings, the perjury standards applied. The penalty upon conviction is a fine or imprisonment